we've invited Nick to come and talk to us today for a number of reasons, really. One of the things that we've been talking about this week is what the students on the Health Organisation and Policy module kind of want to do next and what they want to do in the world. And one of the things that they've talked about wanting to do is making a difference, making a change, improving health services, improving health systems even. And Nick's actually done quite a lot of work in a lot of different settings to tackle change and innovation in healthcare and to tackle some of those translation challenges. So Nick's got a pretty illustrious career, actually. I was looking at your biography. What do I say about Nick? Introduce him. Nick has worked with internationally in terms of health policy, including a fairly long spell at the European Commission, including being head of the Health Information Unit there. He's also a chartered psychologist, quite likes doing degrees and studying. He's also been an expert advisor on innovation and implementation for European Observatory Health Policies. And we met when Nick and I were both doing our doctorate here at Oxford. And he's also worked here as a senior researcher and as a fellow of Huntington College. Nick was actually the founder of HOC, the Health Organisations and Policy Module, which is hosting this guest tonight. It was his brainchild, and we had a happy time teaching together on the HOC module last year. Nick then got a fantastic new job and left me to take over the reins and take HOC forward in a slightly different direction, but very much building on his brilliant ideas and the work that he did set it up. We've invited Nick to come back and talk to us, partly because it's really, really nice to see him, and we're going to go to the pub afterwards, but also because he's now got this new job as Research Group Director for RAND Europe. And I don't know whether you're going to say a bit about what RAND Europe does in your talk, but it's a really interesting opportunity to hear from him a bit more about the role of research in translational health sciences, and to hear about what you can do and work in different settings to make a difference, to innovate and change. So, with no further ado, over to you, Nick.
Thank you very much indeed, Gemma. All nice things to be taken with a pinch of salt, and many thanks to you for the invitation to come here. So let me introduce myself just to confirm, because apart from anything else, I need to pay credit to a few different organisations who I'm speaking with, not on behalf of, but with thanks to this evening, I'll put it that way. So as Gemma's already said, you can see these up here. By the way, in case anyone is worrying, we will put a version of this up on Canvas afterwards, so don't worry about notes and stuff like that. I'll tell you a bit more about what that job for RAND Europe means, but just to describe up front, RAND is an independent non-profit research institute doing independent research for policy and decision making. That's what we do. A lot of history behind that, which I can explain a bit more. I still have links to the University of Oxford, as you can see up there, and to the European Observatory on Health Systems and Policies. And colleagues, you are a little bit of a test group. I don't know if you're happy with this, but I, together with some colleagues at the European Observatory, we're writing a book on innovation and implementation. And so I am road testing some of the material from that this evening, which means your comments and feedback and questions will be especially welcome, because you'll help to improve the book. And particularly good questions and insights will get a mention in the acknowledgement section. And that draws also on RAND Europe's work on health innovation and on my previous role here, working in particular with Trish on the theme that she led on, if you like, the social science part of itself, a really interesting partnership for innovation in health between the university and the hospital. So, credits and background. What am I going to talk about today? I'm going to talk about this topic of knowledge for bright ideas, how research can support innovative health systems. And I'm going to break this down into a bit of an initial introduction. So I you know, this is Oxford. I do have to do a little bit of academic theory and background and all the rest of that kind of stuff. Apologies. But then, because of the space that I now work in, what I'm also really interested in is how does this relate to policy questions? And the three policy questions that I want to talk about this evening are: how do we get the innovations that we want? Because one thing is innovation, and we sort of think that innovation is always a good thing, but innovation is not always a good thing. And also, there are good innovations that we don't yet have. Yeah. And I think during COVID, we've all seen that you know, the scale of the gaps that could exist between what we would like to have and what we actually have. So how do we get the innovations that we want? How do we make the best use of the innovations that we do have? And this is the one that really bothers the national health ministries and the other people in charge of health systems, how do we pay for it? Because colleagues, has everybody heard about the challenge of demographic aging for health systems? This is the key challenge in terms of long-term costs for our health systems, right? Lots of nodding. I hate to break it to you, but you're wrong. The key challenge facing the future sustainability of health systems, the reason why they have expanded in cost for the last 50 years, and the key challenge as to whether or not we will be able to afford them for the next 50 years, is not aging. Aging is relatively minor. Lots of evidence on that, which I won't go into tonight. It's innovation. It's this. It's new products, new techniques. Basically, the good part of this story is we have lots of new ways of treating and intervening and improving health. The bad part is, as we become more and more capable, we have a bigger and bigger size of opportunity that we have to pay for. And that's the key challenge, which underpins that third question. How do we pay for it? So, let's get into it. Start with a bit of background. For some, at least, this will be extremely familiar territory. So tell me, Gemma, if I need to skip over this kind of stuff.
We did go through this actually in quite that way. Worth a fusion of innovations, but it's probably worth a quick recap because not everyone in the room has been on the course all week. So
awesome. Okay. So let's start with what is an innovation. And the classic definition comes from Everett Rogers' book, Diffusion of Innovations, an idea or a practice or a technology that is perceived as new. So there's two things to note in that definition. One, it's really broad, right? An idea or a practice or a technology. There's all sorts of things which can be innovations. Masks, wearing masks to prevent transmission of COVID. Arguably an innovation. Masks aren't new. Masks have been around for ages. But this way of using them, bit of a different way, perhaps more so for some countries than others, which brings us to the other point, which is perceived as new. If it's new here, it's an innovation. Over there, it might be old hat, boring, and they do it all the time. But if it's new here, it's an innovation. And so it isn't some kind of objective thing that has never existed before. That is, to distinguish terms, the very first time that something is conceived of, we would better call an invention. The very, you know, that first insight, that first discovery of something that, like penicillin in a dish or something like that, that is an invention. But when you can actually take it into something where you or someone else might make use of it, that's when it becomes an innovation. And that doesn't have to be new once. It can be new in where you are. Stages of innovation. I'm going to come back to this and we'll talk a bit more about these different stages as we go through. But I just wanted to sort of talk about... Oh, that's not terribly clear, actually. Let's see if we can make that a bit bigger. It's clearer on my screen, which isn't any up to you all. It's just to say that when we talk about innovation, an innovation doesn't just sort of arise and then suddenly is magically everywhere. You've got stages that we need to be thinking about, stages that this process goes through. And from the point of view of a course like HOP, health organisations and policy, different parts of this system play different roles in these stages as we go through them. And I'm just going to describe a few of them just as a sort of a framework to have in mind as we're going through the rest of the talk. Invention is what I talked about, is, you know, that very first discovery. Where might that take place most plausibly? This is partly a test to see if everyone's awake. Gemma, the answer's no, they're not awake. What's going on? What have you done to them?
At the university, for example, research
yes. I, do you know what? I would have been very distressed if we'd been sat in the University of Oxford and if at least one person hadn't said one place where inventions take place isn't in a university. Other universities are available.
Not here then, obviously.
There's this other city over a little bit to the east of here. Anyway, no one's heard of it. Where else in healthcare in particular, thinking about health, where might else what might there be inventions, that brilliant first insight?
Pharmaceutical.
Yes, in industry. In pharmaceutical because companies, in other types of industry as well. Yep.
I think in time of crisis, we usually come up with a solution and sometimes that could be an invention.
I love that. So, I was talking about a place in terms of, I was thinking geographical place, and you've completely reframed the question into a situation or a context. But yes, of course, in time of crisis, such as we have just had. And where have a lot of those, this is a new way of doing it, but we're just going to do it solutions, where has that taken place in healthcare?
Everywhere.
Hospitals. Yes. So not in your research setting. Not in the people who are making the money from it, but in the people who actually have to fix the problems. And I think that's really important, and we'll come back to it. Then you've got your bright idea. Can you make it work? And so actually, you're right. Pharmaceutical innovation does and can take place in pharmaceutical companies. But actually, the real strength of pharmaceutical companies tends to be later on, because what tends to happen in this process of innovation is that, let's imagine that you've got a brilliant academic or a brilliant clinical researcher, and they come up with this insight into how it might be possible to understand a disease differently, or how they've created a new IT program that diagnoses things in a way that no one's done before. Especially if it's a disease insight, it's almost certainly not immediately a pill you could give to someone, right? You've got a lot of work to do to get from your disease mechanism insight to something you could actually give to someone. That tends to be increasingly where the industry steps in. Because if you're an academic, why would you know how to do that? You probably don't. Even if you've come up with a device that in principle works, your device probably uses gaffer tape and bits of plastic. You can't sell that to someone. But you need engineering and manufacturing skills that you don't have, because you're not that person. Why would you? So the next stages are where you turn this into, well, is this something that can work? Typically, this is a boundary between, say, academia or research into various forms of industry, especially for pharmaceuticals. That development stage quite often involves lots of evidence generation. So even once you've got your product and you think it's safe, you have to generate a lot of evidence to be able to demonstrate to licensing authorities that it is safe. Then you get something which you can actually sell. I've used a very vague word there, which is realization, which is an awful word because it means nothing, but that's why I've used it. because depending on what kind of innovation you're talking about, what step you have to go through to get from the thing that you think is good to the thing that can be generally used looks very different. For drugs, it's licensing. For medical devices, that depends what jurisdiction you're in, but it's quite often a form of certification by standards bodies. It's not licensing by the national regulator. If it's a surgical technique, you might not need anything, or it might be your professional body. So that's what's hiding underneath that blue box, is lots of different ways of getting to market. And then adoption. Nice and simple there. I've even put it as green, because that's the easy bit, isn't it? We'll come back to that as well. So does anyone have any questions on those stages before I go any further?
Are you going to talk about at all about how you might bridge those sort of divisions between the different blocks? Is that something that's
yes.
good?
However, I've already spent way too long on this in comparison. So one of the first bits of feedback to myself is this is far too much material for a short talk. So this is a book length.
I mean, we have covered diffusion of innovations, but I think it's really helpful to see it represented slightly different way. So yeah, it's good to set that scene.
And well, and one of the other things I should say before I move on too far is I have presented that in a linear way. So I presented that as though you start at one end and you go through it and you go to the other. Sometimes it's like that, but part of the whole message that I'm wanting to try and give to you is that it is not actually like that. All of these stages loop backwards and forwards. You get this far. Oh, crap, this doesn't work. You go all the way back. Sometimes the licensing stage, we saw this during COVID, the licensing authorities were quite involved in these early stages. And so I'm presenting it as a nice, simple set of discrete steps. It's not like that. And there's a whole ecosystem, and that word system is something I will come back to. But for now, I'm going to move on. For health, I've already alluded to there being different types of health innovation. And I'm going to distinguish for the purposes of this three different types. And I want to distinguish them not because it's theoretically useful and interesting, but I want to distinguish them because I think it begins to illustrate some of the issues that we have when we think about the role that research plays and how these different sectors interact with each other. And I can see from looking at you all that I shouldn't have put all of that up at once because everyone is really not looking at me. So let's start with biomedical. Pharmaceuticals. This is what we most think of when we think about health innovation, right? Big multinationals. Mostly not the people doing the initial research, as I said, but they're the people who step in once you've got your initial idea, but you need millions to take it through clinical trials. That's their particular role. And as we've also seen recently, they are also the organizations that then have the distribution networks and the processing networks to be able to ensure that things become accessible around the world in principle. Huge product life cycles, huge, very strong intellectual property protection. There is a whole bit in the book, by the way, about different types of intellectual property and the difference between patents and copyright and trademarks. And I'm not going to do that now. I'm just going to say strong and moderate and weak. But it's really interesting. Okay, it's really interesting to me that we have constructed really different ways of protecting different types of intellectual property. And it makes a massive difference to the types of innovations we get. That's why I'm putting it up there. Because you can invest for 20 years in pharmaceuticals because you have intellectual property protection that lasts for decades. Medical devices is a completely different sector. 95% of medical devices companies are SMEs, all small, producing products that last 1 or 2 years. And part of the reason for that is that they don't have anything like the same intellectual property protection. You could basically, imagine I come up with a pulse oximeter. And I come up with a great pulse oximeter, it goes on the end of your finger, marvellous. If someone else can come up with a slightly differently functioning pulse oximeter, they can sell it, as long as it's made in a slightly different way. So how do you keep your profits going? You have to make a slightly better pulse oximeter, and you have to keep updating in a way that the pharmaceutical companies just don't. It's a completely different marketplace, and a lot of that comes down to intellectual property. Then organisational innovations. So is typically not, or one way of thinking about it, is mostly not in the private sector at all. So one group of people who innovate a lot organizationally in ministries, think about things like payment mechanisms, think about things like organizational structures, like initiatives like trying to create integrated care systems. That's an organizational innovation. Or clinical innovations, like how do we get this group of clinicians to work together differently? How do we redesign this patient pathway? There might not be a different pill, there might not be a different medical device, but you're still working differently in a way that creates different health outcomes. And that's an organizational innovation. How much intellectual property protection? Almost none. So how do you make money out of it?
You don't.
Which of course means if you're investing in innovation in this sector, where does the money go?
Of course, because that's where you get your pay from.
Now, I'm not going to spend very long on this. I've been talking about an innovation as a sort of a thing that just happens. But of course, governments, funders, all sorts of people don't just want health innovation to just happen. They really want to actively encourage it, make it happen. And so how do you do that? Is it as simple as just throwing out lots of money? Well, to be honest, when you read a lot of national health innovation strategies, the answer is, yeah, pretty much. But there are some classical theoretical models. One of them is the triple helix model, which is that you have that innovation takes place in this intersection between academia and industry and government. And it's about how do you create these different spaces between these three different actors. And you have what they refer to as hybrid institutions. How do you create institutions that bring these different actors together? And if you looked at what, for example, the NIHR Oxford BRC was doing, some of what it was doing was about trying to create these kinds of spaces. The thing about those spaces, by the way, is that they're quite uncomfortable quite often. Because we all like our clear, yeah, where are we now? We're in the university. Good. Clear. If we were sort of in the university and sort of in industry, that gets a little bit less comfortable. So it's very interesting. There's a whole field of research around this, which I don't have time to talk about this evening. But I also think that model is a bit limited as far as health is concerned. And this is exactly where the answers that some of you gave about where do these innovations come from, for me, is really important. Because so one of the things I want to argue in this book is that actually we don't need a three helix model, we need a five helix model, which I suppose I should call the quintuple helix model, but that really doesn't sound like a good idea, so I don't know what we're going to call it. Because yes, of course, you have government setting the rules and the framework, and you have industry doing what industry does, and you have researchers generating inventions, but you also have the people within the health system who we discussed, and also, and Teresa will be particularly underlining this in her module, we have patients and citizens. So much of the driver of what comes out of our innovation systems comes out from what patients and citizens want. And so for us, I think in health innovation, we need to conceive of where these spaces of interaction are a little bit differently to the way that we do more typically within innovation systems.
How do you fit in the health system into that? It is a little bit more abstract, you know, health system is like...
Yes, oh, absolutely.
You can find a person that is responsible for the government. Academia is the same. There are people behind every single of them, of health systems. Do you mean Minister of Health or the, like, do you mean hospitals in
Tokyo? No, I mean people working in providing healthcare and paying for healthcare. So I mean people within the actual provision of health within the system as a whole. Definitely people. Very few of them are not people. although knowing some of the surgeons, anyway, that's a whole separate discussion. Then I'm going to do this really, really quickly because I think again you have almost certainly covered this in the talk, in the course so far, which is about that. Remember, I said that last stage of adoption. That's the easy bit, right? You've got right. Okay. That is actually possibly the hardest bit of all. Right, okay, lots of nodding. I don't need to spend time on this. So I'm just going to say, you have all these different models. I'm sure you've talked about diffusion of innovation. Trish will kill me, but the one that I put up here is Dan Schroeder's Consolidated Framework for Implementation Research, which is this one. We also, obviously, Trish is the lead author on the NAS framework, which is another way and more up-to-date way, perhaps, of looking at this. The key point about all of these is just to emphasize that we tend to, when we talk about adoption of innovations, we very naturally, I mean, what's the noun we're talking about? We're talking about the innovation. If there is one message to take out of all of this work, I would say, is that the innovation is only one component of a much more complicated context and setting, and you cannot expect to achieve anything in terms of implementation without looking at that. We do a lot of work in RAND, by the way, around exactly this, you know, understanding why particular innovations did or did not work in particular settings. And it is always about the setting. It's almost never about the innovation without going into more detail, which I've just put up there as the importance of context. Gemma mentioned the importance of talking about research and what role research plays in all of this, and I'm not going to have time to talk about this as much as I would want to and leave time for questions. But I'm just going to say, when you look back over all of these stages that I've described, hopefully you can see that research is important across all of these different stages. And all of these different types of innovation, right? The key thing I would say about it is the actual research that is done is very unevenly distributed across all of that. So the overwhelming priority of research in terms of the types of innovation, as you said, is heavily concentrated on biomedical, somewhat technological, and almost not on organizational. And in terms of the stages, the research is, the funding is overwhelmingly up here. And basically, as you go along this process, you get less and less actual research engagement with these different stages and with the processes that are taking place. So yes, research can help with all of these stages, but in practice, the money all sits in a few parts of this process. So far, so straightforward. This is the context. This is the background. I know. Half an hour and we're still on background. I'm really sorry. We're going to get onto the policy questions. So first question. We'll do questions as we go through. First of all, how do we get the innovations that we want? One way would be to understand what we want. That sounds obvious. It's actually not. So actual research looking at what the needs are that we have is not readily available. There are some obvious ones. We have a mapping of burden of disease, lots of leading work for years, which, you know, WHO has published lots of work out of that. There's the entire center about mapping the global burden of disease. But a burden of disease isn't the same thing as a health need, because some of those areas have acceptable treatments and have acceptable diagnostics, but which aren't implemented. Some of them have no treatment whatsoever. And what we don't have is good mapping about how those different things fit together. And at what stage the research need is. Is the research need, we have nothing? Is the research need, we have something, but it doesn't work for these people? Is the research need, we have exactly what we need, but most people can't afford to pay for it? Those are completely different research needs in terms of what we need to address. There are some very obvious areas which always get highlighted. Mental health is one, consistently under-researched. There's the obvious area, if you look at a global level, of neglected diseases. There's the triumvirate, which we have been talking about rather depressingly for nearly as long as I've been in this business, which is now too long, of HIV, TB, and malaria. I'm going to need to pick on those three. And there's areas which have become, which have always been Cinderella areas of health and care policy, and which I think has been really highlighted during the pandemic, which is social care, which is non-clinical care, which we under-research horribly. And then, as I said, different stages are really under-resourced, different types of areas are really under-resourced. We have this marvellous work that is done here and has been done, for example, through the Oxford BRC, on involving patients and the public in trying to set and define research priorities. Because fundamentally, if you're going to put a lot of public money into different areas of research, to ensure that that actually meets not just the needs that the experts think, but the needs that the community thinks are relevant, you have to have some means of engaging with the community. But that again, is itself a topic of research and not one which is huge as researched as it might be. So first of all, to understand what we need. Then, we need to think about how we actually align the system. One of the things that will have struck you, hopefully, about the innovation structures which I'm talking about is that it is essentially a mix of actors from different sectors. Come back to that triple helix model. It's industry, as well as government, as well as universities. You have lots of different actors in this. And we think of it as a market. And we've tried different solutions. I should have explained APCs, advanced purchase commitments. This is a topic that's been a tactic that's been used for some particular conditions, such as the neglected diseases. There are others, such as additional intellectual property protections for things like rare diseases, which both the EU and the US have tried, which have had effects. But creating a market at the end of a 20-year development cycle doesn't necessarily influence the behaviour of the academic who is currently researching things, or even the early stage development. Anyone who's ever had any contact with pharmaceutical companies will have heard the expression quarterly report. A market which is 20 years away doesn't do a lot to influence the perspectives necessarily of the people looking at their quarterly outcomes. So just creating markets doesn't create solutions. You need to build stronger links between the stages. One other topic, I'm slightly skipping for a point of time. Talking about these different actors within the innovation system, I want to highlight the role of failure. We don't often talk about failure. We like to gloss over failure as quickly as possible and move on and talk about success. It's a much nicer thing to be talking about. But failure is inherent to innovation. The whole point about innovation is it's something new and something different. If you're not willing to fail, trust me, you're not going to be very innovative. How willing is the public sector to fail? When it's public money on the line, how well is failure tolerated?
Less than 5.
I was just going to say, especially from some people who I know have worked in the public sector, I'm seeing some no room for failure at all. So one reaction that we quite often have as people who come to the health sector with strong values to universality, to solidarity, to access for all, is we look at the private sector and be a bit kind of like, oh, why are those people here? Aren't they just making all of this money? But one of the reasons why the private sector is here, because failure is much better tolerated in the private sector. But that's because failure also comes alongside the potential for rewards. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, how do we balance that? How do we ensure that the rewards which are being given are the ones that we want and are fair in comparison to the degree of failure? One other point I'm going to make here is about what this all looks like from a global perspective. It's very easy for us here to focus on the UK, to focus on Europe. But again, saw very clearly during COVID, innovation is something global, right? If you think about all the different stages of that, if you think about the supply chain, where does it come from? But even more fundamentally, when you're developing your product, one of the things that you need to think about is, well, where am I going to sell this? Who are my clients? And the US market is as large as the rest of the world put together in terms of healthcare. So who do we design our health innovation system for? Overwhelmingly, the United States. So if you invent something here in this marvelous University of Oxford, and you go to the Oxford University Innovation, which is the technology transfer office, and they're advising you on where you're going to take your brilliant life-saving invention and how you're going to develop it into something, do you know where they're going to advise you to look? Are they going to advise you to look at the NHS? Are they? Hell, the NHS insists on really good value for money and wants lots of evidence. No, they're not going to tell you to look here. They're going to tell you to go to America. So what are we getting at a global level? We're getting innovation adapted to the US market because that's where the money is. Nobody designed it that way. And there are quite a lot of American politicians who would rather it didn't work that way. But that's where we are. I'm going to skip really quickly through these next two. That's mainly to you, Gemma, in case you're looking at time. This slightly recaps some of the stuff I was talking about before. So I think, have you talked about health technology assessment?
Not on this module, but on the Stuart and Yarnin's module.
Yes, of course.
Some people have come fresh from that. So.
In that case, you can tell me. So it's very interesting. So obviously one of the key ways in which we can ensure that we are making best use of the innovations that we have is to understand the value that those innovations bring. But one of the key things about health tech, or one of the weaknesses about health technology assessment, he said, trying to find the relevant bit of the presentation, is if you think about that whole chain, that whole process, it is, oh, for Pete's sake, I haven't done this in a while, you can't tell, can you? HTA sits about here. Just after licensing. You decide if something is safe, you give it a license, and then you decide if you want to pay for it. And that's where HTA sits. How much of the innovation process has happened by that point?
Not much.
I think 99%.
Exactly. 99. You've pretty much defined everything that you're doing by this point.
So
there's not much left to do. That's exactly my point. There's very little room at this point. So we're standing at the end of this process with our checkbook, deciding whether or not we want to pay for it. But the it has already been shaped. So one of the key issues is not just making our understandings of value, making that assessment here. It's building that assessment in back here and finding ways of doing that, which at the moment we're not very good at. So health technology assessment. To be fair to the HTA agencies, they do try and do that, but there are all sorts of barriers in the way of it. Implementation we've talked about. One final thing I'm going to say about policy. When you sit in the ministry, I have sat in the ministry, you like to think that you're in charge. It's a wonderful delusion that you sort of have to have, otherwise it gets very uncomfortable and you think, well, what am I doing here? And we all participate in this delusion, by the way, because we all hold health ministers accountable for what happens in the health system. Whilst, to be honest, if we were completely fair with ourselves and with them, we would admit that most of what happens in a health system has got very little to do with the health minister at all. What can the health minister realistically control about their health system? Money. That's the big one. How much money have you got? Can they control what happens in a particular hospital? No, not really. I mean, they can certainly make it more or less easy and they can influence things. But actually, policy has much less control over how these processes happen than policy likes to think. So the reality of this is that what does policy do? Policy should be trying to support processes of local adaptation, local innovation. But when you do that, you have to accept that you're not actually in charge, and it's the people in each of these local situations who are in charge and who are making things change. Now, that's very constructive. It reflects complex systems theory. It reflects our understanding of how health systems work. But if you're a policymaker, it makes you sound almost irrelevant.
That's pointless.
And I don't know very many people in ministries who like feeling pointless. So. And then how do we pay? Well, the easiest way to work out how we can pay for innovation is to get these two things right. Get the right innovations and make best use of the innovations that we've got. One thing we could do is we could much better account for the contribution of health to the wider economy. Because at the moment, we see all the cost of what we spend on health, but we don't build into that budget everything that we gain from health. And again, have we not seen in the last 2 years everything that we gain when people are healthy and everything that we lose when people aren't? We don't account for that. We could do better. That whole field was kicked off or crystallized by the Sachs report on the Global Commission on Macroeconomics and Health. It must be 20 years ago now. But the big agenda is creating better links between all of these stages of the health system. And I won't go into the example of AMR other than to say, if we think about this innovation system, and I've described it as a system, I've spent this whole evening describing it as a system. But if we were to go into it, no one talks about this entire set of activities as a system. We don't think of it as a system. We have different policies for different bits of it. But my fundamental point, the reason why we want to write the bloody book, is because I think we should think of it as a system. Because when you start to see that whole process as one interlocking set of activities that should be giving us what we need in a way that enables us to implement it in practice and make use of it in practice and do so in a way that we can afford, then you start to see that our current structure of everything from intellectual property to research funding to orientations and incentives within markets isn't well aligned to achieve those objectives. And we're doing a shorter time. We'll come back to questions in a sec. If you want a pandemic example, I've run out of time, so I won't go into it in detail, but I will just illustrate. We've had a very hot pandemic in the last 2 years, a very urgent and visible one. Mm-hmm. What is often described as the slow motion pandemic is antimicrobial resistance. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it, you see a system, you see public actors, private actors, everything from vets to farmers to individual doctors to members of the public. You see a research base that has to be generating new antibiotics, but also generating things like point of care diagnostics so that we use the right antibiotic for the particular conditions that people have. We see a global issue where what happens in one country very much affects what happens in other countries. And we are only going to overcome that challenge by seeing the overall innovation system as a system. And at the moment, we kind of don't. And so the reason for writing the book is to try and get us to see that overall system as an innovation system